This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today, we're talking about the current state of the workplace in Indiana. Later in the show, we'll learn about incentive programs that are paying people to move to a community and work a remote job there. Then we'll dive deeper into the economics behind remote working and what kind of long-term impact the pandemic might have on how we do our jobs. But first, we'll speak with our workforce reporter about recent complaints from some business owners that unemployment checks are keeping new workers from coming in and why some say that isn't necessarily true. If you have any questions or comments for the show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. With us now is Justin Hicks, Workforce Development Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Justin.
Hey, Miriam. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing on this beautiful sunny day?
I'm hanging in there.
Well, let's talk about this new jobs report that came out on Friday. Was there anything interesting there that we should know about?
Yeah, so the jobs report, the big kind of headlines that you're going to hear, the U.S., and this is the nation as a whole, right? Not just Indiana, but the U.S. added 559,000 jobs. The vast majority of those were in leisure, hospitality, and restaurants. So those are industries that kind of got a big hurting last year about this time. And of course, now that we're entering into summer, it's also kind of the go season for leisure and hospitality, right? So we kind of expect to see a little bit of a bump there. So those are good things. That resulted in, actually, let me go first. At the same time that we kind of added jobs, meaning that more people got jobs, the labor force actually decreased just a little bit. And the labor force is the number of people who are working or actively looking for work, right? So that's important because when we talk about unemployment, you have to talk about the labor force, the number of people who want a job. That's the total number of people who have a job and want a job. That went down a little bit. And the unemployment rate, which is made up of the numerator, how many people have a job, and the denominator, how many people are looking for a job and have a job. When the denominator gets a little bit smaller and the numerator gets a little bit bigger, any middle school math teacher will tell you that affects percentage. So our percentage, the unemployment rate, went down about 0.3% to 5.9%. So that's kind of the statistical geeky look at those numbers. I will say some other big insights, though, are that the unemployment rate for certain populations, notably Blacks and Asians and some other populations in there, did not really change at all. So that's leading a lot of people to think that maybe this economic recovery isn't so equal for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And just to understand what you're saying, was this jobs report showing any positive improvements overall? Was it just so small of a change that it really didn't make a difference?
It was definitely positive. It was definitely a good thing. How positive depends on who you ask. I mean, I always think of the Mark Twain quote, there's lies, damned lies, and statistics. People had expectations for this jobs report. It fell short of some people's expectations, and it was historic, depending on who you talk to. So, of course, the White House is going to say this is historic job growth because it is, but we also just came from a really historically bad time. So you kind of need historic growth to kind of catch up. And, of course, if you're not in the White House and you're actively against some of those policies, you're going to say, well, this wasn't anywhere close to what it should have been. So it depends on who you ask as to whether it was a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, what about you did a feature story recently about this phrase we keep hearing from folks, business owners, saying that we can't hire people because they're staying at home because they got unemployment checks. They've got COVID relief. They're not going to apply to jobs. What did you find out with your story?
Yeah. So over the past year, I've talked to tons of people accessing unemployment systems, whether it was state UI or PUA, these federal benefits. It just struck me that everyone I talked to for the past year has said, I really want to get back to work. Staying at home is boring. I would love to interact with people again. And also, I want that stability. You know, the unemployment system was very unstable for a lot of people. So when I kept hearing businesses say, well, it's the unemployment benefits, I thought to myself, that doesn't really jive with what I've heard from people over the past year. So I talked to a bunch of people there and talked to economists, and basically what it boils down to for a lot of people is pay needs to be better for them to come back to work, or they need childcare. Childcare is still a really big issue. I mean, it always has been, but the pandemic just exacerbated it to the point where people said, when I do the math, when I say, if I went back to work and got paid X dollars an hour, but my childcare cost Y amount, X and Y don't match up there. X needs to be bigger, a little bit bigger than Y, right? So I can pay for childcare and put food on the table. So that was a big thing for a lot of people. And that's not even factoring in, by the way, the people who are still concerned about going back to work and being shoulder to shoulder with people, especially if you're in like a manufacturing setting. So there's just still a lot of health concerns out there too, whether it's necessarily either pre-existing condition or I'm just nervous.
Right, right. And I think what you said about, you know, the pandemic sort of gave everyone time to pause and reflect and look back at things that, you know, you get caught up in the rat race, so to speak, and you're going to work, you're coming home, and you don't actually look at the numbers. And when you do, it's like, well, why am I going in for that? What about, you know, when you were doing this story, what did you hear from business owners when you sort of, were you able to tell them this is what you're hearing?
I was. And actually, I think something kind of interesting happened while I was reporting on this feature. It took a couple of weeks to report on. And I will say, I think in the very beginning of my reporting, almost every business owner I talked to said, unemployment is keeping people out of the work. You know, they were kind of lockstep about that. But then after a couple of weeks, I went to a couple of job fairs and talked to a few more employers. And I heard a couple of employers say, well, I'm not really sure anymore if it's unemployment. I mean, they've said, I've talked to some people, we've done some interviews, and we know that people have other concerns. It's not just unemployment. And so I heard from a lot of employers in conversations I had, they were kind of wondering and asking me as a reporter, what are you hearing from other businesses? Because, you know, we were sitting around the table and we were thinking, like, what if we made health benefits a little bit better? What if we tried to offer people a stipend for childcare? You know, they were kind of sitting around and asking me, what have you heard from other people? Because, you know, we want to do this maybe if it helps people get to the workforce, but we don't want to be the only ones a little bit. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, I think more employers are now coming around to the idea of maybe we do need to raise wages, maybe we do need to make things more attractive for workers. But definitely, I would say a month or two ago, there was this just really strong impression of, oh, it's got to be the unemployment benefits.
Right, right. I wonder how much like the minimum wage factors into things. I was quickly looking up minimum wage in Indiana versus other states, and I was like, whoa, Indiana has some pretty low minimum wage compared to even its next door neighbors. Does that factor at all into folks deciding whether they're going to go back or not?
I don't think the minimum wage necessarily does, because I will say there's a lot of places that are not paying minimum wage. Let me rephrase that. Because of market competition, right? If you pay minimum wage, it's really hard for you to find workers, and that's always been true. So sort of the free market theory is always, we don't need a minimum wage because if everyone's competing, then raises will rise naturally. And that kind of does happen. So that is one thing to put in there. I will say, again, going back to the idea of anytime that you hear about these labor market statistics, think about who is telling you those statistics and what their motivation might be. So, for instance, the Indiana Democrats did a press conference a couple weeks ago using labor market statistics, saying, this is proof right here that the unemployment, that the minimum wage is too low. And that's what's driving all of this. But of course, Democrats have been trying to pass minimum wage reform for 7 or 8 years now, probably longer. So of course, it feeds into that narrative that they want to tell. No judgment whether that's good or bad, of course. But, just think about how these statistics can be used by certain people to feed certain narratives.
And what about, you know, when it comes to this whole debate, are economists weighing in on this? Do they have any sort of points of view of whether it's the unemployment benefits keeping people, it's health concerns? What are their thoughts?
Yeah, so economists, there was a study that was done recently, and I keep trying to find the link for it, and I'm having trouble with it right now. But I heard this on Marketplace, NPR's Marketplace just the other day, where there was a study that was done recently. They said that only about 1 in 7 people who are on unemployment are actually staying out of the workforce due to unemployment benefits, being a little bit more generous now. So to be sure, I think most economists will say, yes, it does have some impact. Unemployment benefits being a little more generous does have some impact. But a lot of them say it's very small to almost negligible. They say that the really big things to think about are health concerns, childcare, economic issues. They say like that's where you want to spend your attention right now. Pay, right? Spend your attention on those things that you can control. And the unemployment benefits are helping people who, you know, who really are in honest to God, not great situations right now.
Right. And when we talk about unemployment here in Indiana, are there any parts of the state where things are worse off than other parts?
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. You know, we always talk about the statewide percentage, which right now is 3.9%, by the way. We always kind of talk about it as a big state lockstep thing. But it's really interesting when you look at different counties. I just put up a map here that has the unemployment rate for each county. You'll see that certain counties have higher than the state. So it typically falls on mostly urban counties will have slightly higher unemployment rates than the rest of the state. You can, at this moment, you can pretty much chalk that up to probably health concerns, right? If there's a higher density population, you may have people who are a little bit more concerned about health. You may also be able to chalk that up a little bit to politics. Unemployment rates are generally a little bit higher in the urban areas, just in general. But I will say some interesting places that pop out to me. Northwest Indiana has slightly higher unemployment there. In my mind, I kind of think of that as like steel territory. And I know that there were some steel layoffs during the pandemic, and those may have not recovered yet. There's also supply chain shortages all over the place, so that may be a thing. We're seeing, you know, slightly higher rates in Terre Haute. Evansville, Indianapolis is slightly higher. Another interesting place is sort of Howard, Miami counties. So I kind of think of that as the Kokomo area, really big into auto manufacturing. And again, we know that there's supply chain shortages there right now that might be affecting those things too. So it's just kind of interesting to look at the map, think to yourself, what are the major industries in those areas? And then how are those industries doing right now?
Right, especially with the pandemic and how it's hit a lot of the supply chains.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, I want to thank you, Justin, for... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to add on the flip side of that. You look at Elkhart County, by the way, where RVs are going gangbusters, and unemployment rate is really low there. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is all very interesting. And now I'm getting excited about learning about statistics. So thank you very much. Justin Hicks is the Workforce Development Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. When we come back, we'll talk about new trends in remote working and why some communities are paying people to move there and work remotely. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about new trends in the workplace in Indiana and around the country. The pandemic has had a massive impact on how a lot of people do their jobs, and some companies say they have no plans of going back to the office. While some folks may be considering permanent remote work, there are some incentive programs from cities and towns that will pay people to move there and work a remote job. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now to talk more about remote work and the future of remote work, Evan Hawk, co-founder of Make My Move. Welcome, Evan.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to talk about the significant shift that we've been seeing with remote work. You know, the pandemic really highlighted this. Are you seeing this as something that's going to continue?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what we're seeing is a massive shift in American life. Remote work was growing for a lot of years pre-pandemic. You know, there were about 5 million remote workers in the U.S. Before the pandemic hit, and that has exploded since the pandemic. We think about 60 million people are currently working remotely. And by and large, what we're hearing is that remote workers have loved it. You know, it's given them flexibility in their lives. It's they have more time with their family, better quality of life. And companies, I think, have found it to be a really constructive arrangement, too. They get more productivity for less money and able to retain their people. So I think when we look at sort of the macro trends, remote work is here to stay.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk to you about Make My Move, your organization, your company. How do you fit into this space of remote work?
So Make My Move is an online marketplace. We connect remote workers to the more than 36 communities that are offering relocation incentives. So across the country, communities are realizing that these remote workers are newly mobile. And if they recruit them, those people bring net new income to the region. So as a means of economic development, they're out there recruiting them, and they're giving some pretty rich incentives to do so, you know, up to $20,000 for people to relocate to a new region.
And how did you come up with this idea of being able to find all these places and put them together? I checked out the website, and now I'm like, there's so many places I want to move to. But, you know, how did you find out that this was happening?
You know, we really just saw a gap in the market. So our core business is a talent attraction business. And during the pandemic, a lot of companies stopped hiring. But we found that so many remote workers were remote for the first time and starting to look for new places to live. But there wasn't an easy way for them to find all of the offers that were available to them. We're actually shocked that there wasn't a site like this before us. So sort of as a opportunity came about, we spun up the website in December. We've really been blown away by the interest, both from the remote workers who find it as an easy way to find offers that are available to them. But it's also great for the communities. It's a marketing channel that they can use and influence the remote workers and convince them to make a move.
Now, for our listeners, what can you give us some of the examples of what these incentive programs are? What does it mean?
Yeah, so maybe the pioneer in the space is Tulsa, Oklahoma. So they were the very first to do this, and they actually set up their offer 3 years ago now. They offer $10,000 in cash plus a host of amenities for people that that make a move if they're willing to relocate from outside of Oklahoma to Tulsa. But across the country, there are all kinds of these offers. So like Southwest Michigan offers $15,000 in mortgage loan forgiveness for people that relocate to St. Joseph or Benton Harbor. College towns like Purdue University and West Lafayette, Indiana, are offering programs where, in addition to $5,000 in cash, they're offering a bunch of university amenities like access to libraries, discounts on co-working space, and continuing education. So it's really interesting to see as the competition between these communities sort of heats up, they're finding all kinds of creative ways to attract workers, whether it be sort of selling the amenities of the community or just making it sort of financially beneficial to make that move.
Well, are you seeing numbers of people taking these offers? Like, do you have any data on folks that are actually taking these opportunities and going with it?
Yeah, you know, we think that about 500,000 people will move interstate each year. I mean, just even in our short time of operating this site, we've seen over 10,000 remote workers come through and apply for the incentives. The individual communities don't all report the numbers of people that have made a move. But we think that, you know, this is going to be a massive trend over the next few years as really people are leaving the big cities en masse. You know, those cities have become unlivable. They're expensive. They're crowded. And I don't know if you saw the recent census data. A lot of this even predated the pandemic. People were leaving the big cities in search of a better lifestyle. And so a lot of these communities that are offering these incentives, they're great places to live. Maybe they've just been considered flyover territory before. So whether folks are wanting, you know, to buy a home, maybe a place with a little bit more space, a place they can raise a family, be closer to family, or just be closer to, you know, certain amenities that they're looking for, you know, mountains or the water. The really key thing to remember is they're able to choose for the first time. They're not wed to wherever their employer is located. And so it's an opportunity for them to pick a place that actually matches their lifestyle. And we think that it's going to be a massive trend.
Well, what about, you know, folks who might be sick of working from home because of the pandemic and they're ready to just go back in person and see people? Are you seeing that at all as having any effect or impact, or do you think it won't?
You know, I don't want to minimize the fact that, you know, there could be people that want to come back to an office, but we think it's going to be a small number. The folks that we talk to, even in a pandemic, have enjoyed the arrangement. You know, I'll point out that working remotely is not necessarily the same as working from home. You know, during the pandemic, we were working from home with family obligations, with, you know, lots of distractions. Really, the promise of remote work is that you're in control. You can control your schedule. You can control where you are. So, you know, we're finding that people are availing themselves to that that control, and, you know, maybe going and spending a month on the beach, and maybe spending a month with relatives. It's really an opportunity for them to sort of connect with the things that they value. And I just don't think that many people will give up that freedom willingly.
Well, that's a good point that you make. That I think when we think of remote work now, for those of us that are new to this because of the pandemic, yes, it's a lot of obligation. You've got your family, the kids are schooling from home. But I think you're talking more about the future, where it's, let's say, the pandemic hopefully is over and kids are back in school and you're working remotely, so you don't have so many things going on.
That's right. Yeah, you know, I think even more than that, this is a huge economic story. You know, when you think about historically, the value of a job was owned by the companies. You know, so when Salesforce decides to set up shop in San Francisco or Indianapolis, where we're from, they control the economic value of those jobs. And it's why communities historically have given those companies rich incentives to relocate their headquarters. With remote work, the economic value of those jobs has been transferred to the individual. And those jobs are really valuable. What we're finding is that these remote workers are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars to their local communities. So it's the tax revenue that they bring. They're going to buy a house. They're going to spend, you know, buy food and eat out in the local economy. And so, you know, they're enormously valuable. And that's why we're seeing some of these communities directly incentivizing these people to move. And again, I think as the remote workers both recognize the freedom they have and recognize the economic value that that they control, you know, I think they're in the driver's seat.
Well, when it comes to these communities that are offering these incentives for people to move there and work remotely, are there certain trends among them? Are these smaller towns that are looking to bring in additional revenue? What sets them apart?
Yeah, it runs the gamut. I mean, in each of these places, you have sort of a sponsor that really believes in talent attraction. You know, that might be the local economic development corporation or chamber of commerce, could be private foundation. But it really comes down to who is investing. Now, there are all kinds of different communities that are doing this. You know, we're spinning up a program in Southwest Indiana, you know, places like Jasper and French Lick, where, you know, these are, you know, more rural communities that have historically shed talent. You know, there have been lots of people leaving over the last 10, 20 years. And so they're making a point to start recruiting people back. You have cities, but maybe, you know, second or third tier cities like I mentioned Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Topeka, Kansas, you know, Northwest Arkansas being great examples. And then you have, you know, some programs that are sort of statewide, where West Virginia is recruiting people to many cities across the state. Not just with cash, but with amenities that sort of connect people to the outdoor resources that they have. So park membership and equipment rental. Really what we're finding is that across the country, these communities are sort of what makes their community unique. And then going out and finding people that value those same things and building a community around them.
Well, what about, I know for some of these incentives, there are some rules in place, like you have to live there for at least a year. Is there anything to discourage folks from, you know, moving there for a year and then jumping onto another incentive and moving somewhere else? Or is that okay?
Yeah. With those sorts of issues and trying to figure out how to make them sustainable in the long run. You know, it's important to know that it's expensive to move. So, you know, that a $5,000 or $10,000 incentive probably doesn't give folks enough to sort of continually jump ship. You know, I think what they're many of the remote workers that we talked to, the dollar figure sort of got their attention, but it was really the community and the sort of ongoing availability of resources is what kept them there and really attracted them to the region. So, you know, the communities that are having the most success are the ones that sort of weave these remote workers into the community really well, getting them integrated with, you know, volunteer opportunities, with networking in the region, help them plant some roots. But, you know, at a minimum, most of these communities require that you stay at least a year, sometimes up to two years. And I think the bet is once you have some of those roots committed, you're there for the long haul.
Well, it sounds like a really great initiative, and we thank you for taking the time to talk to us more about it. Is there anything else on the horizon that we should know about with Make My Move?
Well, there's new offers coming up every week, so come to makemymove.com and check them out.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Evan Hawk is co-founder of Make My Move. Now we're going to switch gears a little and talk about the economic impact of these changes in the workplace. How successful have remote work incentive programs been? With us now to tell us more about it all are Raj Chaudhary, Lumry Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard University, and Tim Bartik, Senior Economist at the Upjohn Institute. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks
for having me.
Raj, I'll start with you. You studied remote working incentive programs, specifically the one in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Our guest before just mentioned it briefly. This program started a few years ago before all of these conversations about remote work and all of the stuff that happened with the pandemic. So what got you interested in it before it was cool?
Sure. So I've been studying, you know, this form of remote work, which I call anywhere, where employees can choose which city, town, or country to live, and not being in the same location as the company. I've been studying this for years. And the way I got into this research stream was I was studying migration, and I was witnessing through my work, my research, all the pain points people have in moving. And then I thought to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful if people could choose instead of the company telling them where to move? And I found this program in the U.S. Patent Office back in 2015, where the Patent Office had allowed its examiners to live anywhere, and people had relocated away from Alexandria, Virginia. And they did this in 2012. And then that got me motivated to study the productivity effects of such a move. And I found it was productivity enhancing. And then I stumbled upon Tulsa Remote in 2018 or 19, and I studied that program in depth.
Wow, that's really interesting just to hear the evolution of it all. Tim, have you seen enough from these incentive programs to have an idea of how effective they are? Is it too early to tell? Are they still relatively new?
Yeah, it's too early to tell. I think, you know, I'm a policy wonk, and I think the question that you know, local residents need to ask is, you know, what are the benefits versus costs of these things, and what are the alternatives? I mean, you know, one, the issue is how many of these you're giving out cash to people to move in a lot of cases, and is that actually inducing any movement? Or is a lot of this would have occurred anyway, or for that matter, even if you're inducing that one person to move, unless housing supply expands, someone else might have moved into that house. So, you know, are you actually increasing net in migration? And then the other thing, of course, is what are the spillover effects of that? I mean, if all the person does is move in, I mean, there are some benefits and costs for the local economy. I mean, it brings in some demand. You know, they're going to go out and buy things. That's true. It creates some jobs in the local retail sector. Potentially, there are some skill spillovers. If the remote worker switches later on to working in the local economy, maybe they contribute to having a more productive local economy and will attract other job growth. And then maybe there are some fiscal spillovers, which could be either negative or positive. In other words, the person is bringing in some tax revenue, but potentially demanding services. So, you know, if someone brings in, you know, seven kids, it's expensive to educate seven kids in public schools. That needs to be evaluated. And the issue I would raise is we don't know yet how effective these programs are, and we don't really have good estimates even of the magnitude of some of these spillovers. And, you know, for example, at the extreme, if these policies are just handing out cash and don't actually induce any in-migration, then they're all cost and no benefit. And are there alternative ways of building up skills in the local economy? And the answer is there are. I mean, you could, for example, invest in education of your own residents, and that directly, or if you want to attract remote workers and also benefit your residents, you could invest in amenities, and that helps your residents directly, even if it has no effect on attracting remote workers.
Right, right. So you sound like you're not a fan of incentive-based.
Well, things. I'm not. I don't know whether these programs work or not. I mean, I think you need to, I'm open to maybe we'll discover that these cash incentives are incredibly effective in attracting remote workers, that it induces a lot of in-migration. Maybe we'll estimate these spillovers and decide, for a lot of communities, they're very positive. But, you know, this is not the only way to attract talent or to have talent. You can invest in your education and training system. You can invest in amenities. You can do I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Kalamazoo has the Kalamazoo Promise, a place-based college scholarship program. That program directly benefits people by helping educate their kids go to college, but it also attracts people who want to move to Kalamazoo so their kids can get free college.
And, you know, we'll come back and discuss this more in depth. We're going to take a quick break, and we're talking about incentives and economic impact of remote work. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing the rise of remote working and the impact it's having on workers and communities across the country. And as always, if you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. With us again are Raj Chowdhury, Lumry Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard University, and Tim Bartik, Senior Economist at the Upjohn Institute. Raj, before the break, we touched upon the TULSA program that you researched, this incentive program for folks. How effective would you say that program was?
So I would agree with Tim that it's still early stages of evaluating these programs, but I can share a few facts. So I think the first order effects that we were able to estimate relate to a positive increase in sales tax and different other things that you would expect to see. But like Tim, what I'm really excited about is the multiplier effect. So let me tell you a few things. So what TULSA was able to do was to select a very careful set of cohorts. So they've done it now. I believe this is their third cohort coming in. And this selection has really focused on diversity. So they have really been attracting a very diverse set of workers. And once they do that, so the TULSA Remote Program is run by the George Kaiser Family Foundation. The foundation has been extremely successful in integrating these new remote workers with the community. So I interviewed multiple of these people, and I'll tell you one really compelling story of this African-American gentleman who had moved from the Bronx. And he was not very active back in the community in Bronx, but now he's working in Tulsa, working remotely, and he's the high school debate coach. And I think these things, these success stories are like abound in that community where people have really connected with the community. And it's something that we are going to measure over the years. I was listening into Evan talking about how to retain these workers. So what has happened in the Tulsa case is the incentive check didn't go out as one single payment. They were invited to community dinners every month where folks from the community also joined. And then the checks were given out 12 times a year where people got to see the locals, got to see the migrants got to see the locals. So I think selection and integration into community are absolutely critical mechanisms to drive impact. And I'm not sure that that's happening everywhere, but those are, I would say, necessary conditions for impact.
Would you say, though, that it's more about building a community than it is about creating an incentive for a remote worker then? I mean, I'm just curious, like if it's about community dinners and bonding and building this relationship, maybe that's something that's just lacking everywhere else.
So it's not only just the dinners, it's like, in the selection process itself, first of all, what they did, Tulsa Remote did, was they involved the community in selecting these resumes. So they would have like this event in the town hall where people came and voted with sticky pads. So the golden stickies we had to get. And so it is from the get-go, the community was involved in selection and integration. And now the remote workers are giving back. Because, you know, Tim is right. You could spend the dollars on locals and you don't want the locals to say, why are these dollars being spent on people from outside? And so you need to make this integration really key from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, what are your thoughts? Do you think this is going to be the new trend that we're going to see more cities across the country paying people to move there?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me because one of the political economy of this, of course, is it's easy to hand out cash. Okay. And, you know, so I think at least symbolically, it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of communities experiment with this and try it out. What I'm a little worried about is the communities won't think through about the fact that in order for this to work, it probably has to be fairly highly selective. And as I said, if you think about this, there are alternative policies you can consider. For example, Economic Innovation Group, which is the research organization that thought up Opportunity Zone. The idea would be to try to overcome the immigration debate by allowing communities to choose whether to hand out special visas to immigrants. The equivalent of H-1B visas, which now like kind of high-tech companies can offer special visas to get certain skills. Their idea would be communities, say Flint, Michigan, that could decide we need more immigrants. You know, we're losing population. We're willing to have more immigrants in our community, and you could select skilled immigrants from around the world who are eager to come to the U.S. Well, that program would attract talent to your community, but it wouldn't involve handing out cash. It would involve handing out something valuable, which is a visa to live and work in the United States, which a lot of people in the world are interested in. You know, so there are ways of thinking about this talent attraction that might have the same benefits, but at lower cost.
So other types of incentives aside from money. But I mean, is that the future? Is that what we're looking at, you think?
Well, I think, you know, the U.S. has a problem with relatively slow population growth. And overall, I mean, you know, I which is creating problems with the Social Security system, Medicare and whatever. How do we pay for all this? And people aren't really talking about how we deal with this. I mean, what do you do? Do you somehow increase the birth rate? Do you let in more immigrants? Well, a lot of people don't like that. But, you know, you need to talk about this. How can you build up the talents of our current workforce? So there is this overlying issue, which is, how do we deal with the relatively slow population growth combined with the rising demand for skills in our economy? We need more workers and we need more skilled workers. And so, you know, I think we need to position this debate within that overall picture. I mean, one thing to note about this is these programs, if all they're doing is moving people around the country, we're not increasing the overall supply of skilled workers in the U.S. economy. Right. I mean, which, you know, now maybe we're moving workers from communities that have plenty of skilled workers into the Flint, Michigans of the world. I don't mean to pick on Flint, but, you know, places that could use more skilled workers. And maybe that's a gain. So I think we need to think about this in the overall context of U.S. economic problems.
Right, right. Well, we do have a question from a listener on Twitter who asks, I keep hearing about teacher shortages. Are there any places paying to relocate teachers? Raj, do you know of any programs that are incentivizing specific skills?
So I know the Tulsa program did attract quite a few teachers. And as I said, you know, even these remote workers were doubling up in the high school as coaches for the debate team and other teams. But just to react to, I think, what Tim was saying, I love this idea of local visas. You know, it's been discussed in different forums. But, you know, this remote work program has one advantage over all other programs, which is that when new migrants come in, they need jobs. And for a city like Tulsa, they may not have enough jobs for new migrants. And when you are a remote worker, you don't need a local job. You can work from anywhere, but you're still contributing to the local economy. And maybe in a couple of years, you will start your own company and employ other people. So I think that is what's it breaks this chicken and egg problem of saying, of a small town saying, I can't get companies because there's no talent, and I can't get talent because there's no company. But it needs a lot of investment. So one thing that GKFF had to do was to create this co-working space called 36 Degrees North, which was wonderful. So these remote workers were not working from home. They were working from 36 Degrees North because it had all the privileges of working in a really nice office. And so I think unless you're doing all of these parts, it's difficult to attract quality people and then retain them.
And that's interesting. You're mentioning that remote workers are they're providing to the local economy in a way versus coming and trying to find a job that might not be there. So they're helping, I guess, from one aspect, if we look at it that way. From your study from on Tulsa and the program, did you hear from anyone who didn't end up moving to Tulsa and decided not to go through with it?
I lost your audio, Mariam. Can you just repeat that question again? Please?
Oh, yeah. Did you hear from anyone in your study that didn't end up taking Tulsa up on the offer? And was there any reason why?
Yeah, so that's the study that we are conducting right now. So we're going to compare. We are serving people who moved and then the people who almost moved. And we're going to report those results in the fall.
Okay, we'll definitely want to hear those results. So I'll be reaching out again. And Tim, when it comes to sort of this remote work, you know, you heard Raj saying it can help if you're coming to a community and you're bringing your job with you rather than looking for a job in a place that doesn't have jobs. You know, are you seeing that as a possibility?
Well, sure. I think that's definitely true. I mean, that's why it has a demand effect. I mean, essentially, it's just like a company that is selling its goods and services outside the place. It's bringing new dollars into our local economy. I mean, that's coming from outside. The new dollars are in there. And that person who's a remote worker is going to spend some of those dollars. You know, they may go out and buy some computer paper. They're going to go out to the grocery store. They may go to a bar or restaurant. All of that creates some demand effects in the local economy. It's just like when a new company comes in and hires people and buys supplies, it creates these multiplier effects. The issue is, how many of these remote workers would have moved anyway? I mean, I think a lot depends on what else is going on in the local economy. Do you have a housing supply that is responding to an increased demand? I mean, if you just have, I mean, literally, if you just have a fixed number of houses and each of them is occupied, the fact you bring in some remote workers means someone else doesn't move in. And so you need to take account of that. You better have an elastic housing supply. You better have housing supply policies that are allowing for new apartments and new houses to be built. Otherwise, all you're going to be doing is driving up property prices and not really boosting the local economy. I think Raj raised a good point. You need to have additionals. It needs to be more than cash. Like he's talking about this remote workers having a setting where they could work together to try to encourage them to start up their own businesses and interact with each other. I think that's important to encourage the spillovers you want to see.
Mm-hmm. And what about, are there any sort of consequences, do you think, for communities that, you know, put out these incentives? Obviously, there's money that needs to be done to run these programs. Are there any other costs aside from that?
Well, as I said, I mean, you know, the extreme, generally in the U.S. situation, you know, we do subsidize households with kids. You know, everyone pays property taxes and income taxes and sales tax that goes into the K-12 educational system. And in turn, you put your kids in school, you know, but the average household that has several kids in public school on net is being subsidized by the public sector. That's the way the state local government sector works in the U.S. So, you know, the reality is if a remote worker is bringing along several kids, they may very well be requiring more public services than they are directly contributing in taxes. So you need to look at that.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're, you know, moving that from one state to another. You know, it would have been one state paying for that. So,
well, yeah, that's true. But if we're looking at it from the point of view of the local government that's providing the cash, you know, the full fiscal analysis has to look on the spending side, not just, you just can't say, oh, gee, this is great. We're getting this tax revenue from the remote worker. We're going to count all that as a benefit. You got to look at the fact that people require public services. It is not cost-free to have an additional person living in your community. It costs something in terms of not just K-12, but you know, if you want to have the same police and fire response time, you need to maybe hire additional police and fire. If you want to have the same road congestion level, maybe you need to expand roads a little bit. So people bring public service demands as well in cost, as well as providing tax revenue.
Right, right. And Raj, when it comes to these programs and these incentives, how important is diversity and inclusion when they're accepting applicants? I know you said in some places the community comes together to decide who gets in. So how does that work?
So I think it was a first order consideration for the Tulsa program, especially for George Kaiser Family Foundation, because they really wanted to, you know, everyone knows the difficult past Tulsa has had with race, and they really wanted to sort of like make diversity a first order achievement. And they did. They've attracted a large cohort of African Americans. I've interviewed a single Muslim woman who moved. And it's been wonderful because these folks have become ambassadors in the community in trying to attract people like them to Tulsa. And I feel, you know, what's going to happen, at least in that community, is I'm sure people will start businesses. People are going to sort of create that multiplier effect will play out in many, many ways. Because essentially, that integration has been laid out so solidly. So one of the debates right now happening in that team is, instead of giving that $10,000, what if we help pay for people's down payment for a new house? So I think it's all about retaining and integrating, and then it starts creating the multiplier effects.
Mm-hmm. And what about for the folks that went through with the program, that decided to go through with it? What were their reasons, or did you get a sense of why they decided to accept the offer?
Yeah, so I was really, my prior was that these would be return migrants, that these would be folks who had left Tulsa young and were coming back. Actually, most of them were not from Tulsa. And the predominant profile was this young professional who wanted to start a family and couldn't afford to buy a 3-bedroom house with a lawn somewhere else in San Francisco or in Texas, Austin. So it's typically young working couples moving who look at the cost of living savings, and then they sort of get entrenched.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I mean, I'm just thinking of, like, you know, if you want to work in tech in Silicon Valley, it's so expensive, and this seems like a perfect option for that. Are you seeing a lot of that? Was it mostly driven by tech sector folks?
It's quite a bit of tech. And actually, you know, Enrico Moretti has a wonderful paper where he documents that the nominal wages might be higher in Silicon Valley, but the real income is not that different if you're living in a tier 2 or tier 3 city. So these folks are conditional on holding the same wage as they would have made in Dallas or Silicon Valley. They're making substantively different, higher real incomes. Absolutely. No question about that.
Mm-hmm. So it's definitely more affordable. And, you know, as we get ready to wrap up here, do you see this as becoming the norm, you know, even after things hopefully get better with this pandemic?
So that's definitely the hope, because, you know, I'm a migration scholar and we have studied and talked about brain drain for like 40 years and how the middle has been hollowed out. And, you know, I feel this is a real opportunity to turn the tide back. And one thing I would say, yes, it may not create additional supply shock in terms of talent, unlike the immigrants, but it would lead to a probably more spatially, more equal distribution of the talent. You know, why does all the talent need to congregate in these super cities? And it's creating all kind of second, third order effects and pollution and whatnot there. So, you know, I would be excited to be talent school.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time today. Raj Chaudhry, Lumry Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard University, and Tim Bartik, Senior Economist at the Upjohn Institute. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a conversation on art centers across Indiana. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.